Former President Donald Trump was indicted today for trying to overturn his loss to Joe Biden.
We have to win in November, or we're not going to have Pennsylvania. They'll change the name. They're going to change the name of Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvanians have a unique role with democracy and freedom. We have seen Pennsylvanians rise up at the ballot box.
The work of making this world resemble one that you would prefer to live in is a lunch pail job.
Hi, welcome to the Keystone Reckoning podcast. I'm your host, Jesse White, back for part two with Alexandra Hunt, candidate for Congress in PA03, which is Philly, currently represented by Dwight Evans. So we were talking in the previous conversation about the kind of backlash you were getting from other Democrats in Congress about your campaign. And I have to think they're just like, oh, Jesus, we do not want another AOC. Is that basically what this is?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Have you spoken with her?
I have not spoken with her. I have been weighing the pros and cons of potentially, because she's also a very polarizing figure. And while I agree with her on, I think, all of her platform, she's polarizing. And so I need to think about if she would be helpful or not in helping us win this district.
Do you have any other progressive groups or organizations that have endorsed you or backing you, putting people on the streets for you?
We are in conversation with a couple. We've been endorsed by Blue America, Marion Williamson, Catch Fire, and Penn Justice Dems.
It's got to be hard, you know, in a primary when you're challenging an entrenched incumbent, and Dwight Evans is as entrenched as it gets, you know, in terms of his long history in PA politics. It seems as though, you know, a lot of challengers get hung up on this idea of endorsement, and we've got to get this person and that person, and they don't understand, I think, that your job as a challenger is to go out and kind of prove yourself, right? And kind of, and I've always felt, instead of trying to grab somebody else's following, if you build your own following, it's much more powerful, and then it serves as a kind of a magnet to bring more people to the table.
I hate talking about endorsements. I think that it's a little bit on the superficial level. And I just come from a much deeper place in my going about my life. So I don't enjoy it. And, I can be a little bit neglectful in pursuing endorsements because of that, but there've been different voices advising on our race and saying that, you know, we do need to be building a coalition and demonstrating that with through endorsements. So
yeah,
we've been,
so what you're saying is you have a lot of questionnaires that you still need to fill out. Yes, I hear you. And I always looked at it like this. If an endorsement is one thing, but what does it bring to the table, right? Is it going to bring money to the table? More importantly, is it going to bring bodies to the table? Like, I always used to love SEIU because if you got their endorsement, you had, you know, purple and yellow t-shirts out in the street for you, you know, and in an urban district, in a big congressional district of 700 some thousand people, I mean, you just need as much manpower or man and woman power as you could possibly get. So are you feeling as though you're getting a lot of grassroots volunteers and folks on the ground?
Yeah. And actually those are the endorsements that I'm more likely to go after. There's a couple of different groups that I know bring volunteers to the table. And so I've been saying those are the ones that I want rather than, you know, so-and-so who's a big lefty name, giving their, there's, I get that it helps in some ways, but I really want the volunteers. So yes.
So it's gotta be difficult for you because you're kind of going through this process where, you know, anybody that's a political outsider, and I'm not talking about like the, you know, the hedge fund person who's like, I'm not a politician, you know, which is just the most annoying phrase ever. But like, don't diss what we do to try to get yourself cred, right? That just drives me crazy. But you're, you know, you're someone that's not part of the establishment. You've kind of come up on this on your own, honestly. And now you're in this world, you know, you've got like one foot in this world where there's a very kind of accepted standard way of doing things. And you have to balance out how much of it of that do I have to do to be taken seriously while still maintaining being the person that got me to this place to begin with. Can you talk about that process a little bit? Am I accurate, or are you nodding for those that are listening? I mean, what's that like?
You're so accurate. It there's a line that sticks with me from when I was 19, I think. And I, at the time, I wanted to become a doctor. And so I was a pre-med in college. And I was shadowing an ER physician. And there was another doctor who came in and he saw this case that we were looking at. And he was just like, oh, she, you know, she's just here on anxiety. Kick her out. Throw her out. And I, at 19, I was like, wow, you're really known for your compassion, aren't you? And I said that to a doctor. And the doctor that I was shadowing grabbed me and he like pulled me to the side and he said, don't ever let them break you. And that really stuck with me, is that like that I got to stay true to who I am. And that is telling people off when they're doing something shitty. And if that means that I am unprofessional or not taken as seriously, that's fine. I can work with that. I like being an underdog. So I have no problem with it.
Right. Well, and the other thing that's funny is, you know, we're talking about being professional, right? This is the chamber of Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, I think there's this idea that when you become like an elected official, especially in a legislative body, that you've some, you know, that we'd like to think that those folks are kind of like next level in their, you know, in their intellect and their morals and their, but it's not hard to see that that is just not the case. I mean, the idea that the best people get into office is by far one of the biggest fallacies in politics.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, all right, well, let's talk about, I want to talk about the differences between you and your opponent for a minute, because I have a story about your opponent that I want to tell you, about an experience that I had. But what is...
Did he show up at the end of a protest for a photo op? Because I've been hearing all of those.
Oh, no, this is better. Okay. He didn't have to go anywhere. I was the one that had to go somewhere. But... before we get to it, my question is, tell me the moment you decided to run for Congress. What, because you've clearly done a lot, and you know, you've had, for someone who's 28 years old, you've had a pretty wide range of life experiences. What was your tipping point?
My tipping point was the pandemic. And there was, for me, there was a moment of just like, wow, I'm going to do this now. And that moment was, when the pandemic first struck, I was working at a cancer center and my background's in public health. So I knew the virus was coming and I knew that we weren't responding to it. And because I was working at a cancer center with a very vulnerable population, I was already starting to isolate myself and not go in person. And then it was here and everything shut down. And so I was like, I need to, my city's in need. I need to get out and be there. And so I was at testing sites and helping get out menstrual items and with the homeless encampment that formed. And I was at a food distribution site. And as I was driving there, I saw this huge line and it was like around the building, down the street. And I was like, I wonder what that's for. And when I got there, it was for people in Philadelphia, a large city in the United States, the oldest city in the United States, who were food insecure, who didn't have enough food at home. It was an enormous line. And I just, I had this thought of they're not coming to help us. There's nobody has their boots on the ground. And so I said, you know, what are you waiting for? That this is now. And that's when I decided to run. And I started to look into who was holding the seat, who was missing, who's not on the ground. And it was Dwight Evans. And as I started to peel back what he's done, what he hasn't done, I was like, oh, I'm running against him.
That was my next question. You know, Congress is a big jump for someone that's never held office before. And, you know, I'm sure you probably have had people say, well, you need to pay your dues and run for the state house or do this or do that.
Board of Education.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Has there been any approach made to be like to not quote buy you off, but to kind of, you know, incentivize you to not run right now?
So the Philadelphia Democratic Party often does that with candidates that they don't want running. They have not approached me. I have heard of from other candidates that they've been approached with different seats offered or run against this person, not that person. We'll make sure you get in, which of course is baloney, mm-hmm. but still they're trying. They don't want to talk to me.
I think there's a pretty clear reason for that. I mean, I think they probably realize that you're you put them on blast pretty quickly. I mean, a lot of times you look and you're like, yep, there's no, you know, that person's, they're not transactional, you know?
Right. I think that's what I thought too, is that they either can't figure out what it is that I want or see that what I want is policy changes and they can't give that to me through money.
Right. Right. Yeah. You're not going to get you're not going to take a seat on the parking authority. Right. Like that was always the, oh, right. That was always the place where they sent people to die. So, okay. This lets me segue into my thoughts on Dwight. So I served with Dwight for almost all eight of my years. I think I forget what year he went to Congress, but it was towards the end of my tenure. And So while he was there, he was, for the majority of the time, he was the House Dems Appropriations Chair. And you have to understand what it was like at first. It changed over the course. And I think, honestly, it's why he was like, I'm ready to get out, because he lost his power for the most part. But he was the most powerful person in the caucus, more than the leader, more than anybody, because he controlled the purse strings, right? If you needed anything, you had to go to Dwight. And everything was transactional. You know, if I needed, you know, when they did WHAMs, you know, the walking around money, which I get why it had a bad reputation, but, you know, it was like, okay, we're giving small grants to fire departments and organizations that can use it, like senior centers. The money was going to a good place for good things, you know. But the problem was, you know, there'd be people that towed the party line that were getting, you know, $500,000 in WHAMs. And then there were people like me, they're like, okay, you have $35,000. And I'm like, but I have 21 municipalities. They're like, yeah, but we don't care, because I wasn't on, you know, on the team. And it wasn't even that I was invited to be on the team and turned it down. I just kind of never got, you know, I just never went there. So I'm running for reelection in, I think it was 2010, Tea Party year. A lot of Democrats in Southwestern PA are in trouble. And I was, because of a lot of my positions, you know, I was a little too progressive for my district. So I faced some fundraising challenges. And also my predecessor had like no fundraising experience. So there wasn't a donor base cultivated in the district. So, and I was having a hard time getting support from my own caucus, you know, from the House Dems. So the head of the HDCC says, look, you got to go talk to Dwight. And I was like, okay. And this was like during the summer. He's like, here's what I need you to do. I need you to go see him in Philly in his office. I'm like, really? Can't it just wait till we get back in session? He's like, no, you got to go. I'm like, okay. So I actually flew from, on my own dime, from Pittsburgh to Philly for a day. I don't think I've ever told this story to anybody. I flew to Pittsburgh to Philly for a day.
That was too bad.
Like, got a car, roll up on Ogontz Avenue, and like go and meet with Dwight at his office. And it was like, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Like, I go in there, I'm like, am I supposed to genuflect? Am I supposed to beg? I don't, you know, I'm like, I'm a grown up. I don't know what the hell this is. And like I said, I'm assuming in retrospect, I was supposed to make some sort of an ask that I just never made, like explicitly. And it was so I like went, we like hung out for a couple hours and talked about some, we did talk some policy stuff. I'm not going to say it was totally superficial, but we did talk some policy stuff and things. And he came and he did come later, do a tour of my district, you know, to get a little attention to some things, whatever. But like the money never showed, like the not even the money, the support never showed. It was like a fight the whole way through. I always say, you know, a lot of times running for office, you fight more with your own party than you do the Republicans, you know, when you're in a swing district. And it was, and I got on a plane and flew back home. And my wife was like, how did it go? And I was like, I have no fucking idea. I have no clue what just happened. It was one of the most bizarre days of my life. And it just always stuck with, like, now when I think of Dwight, that's just what sticks with me. And, you know, and the word I always had to associate with him was just transactional. You know, he was a transactional guy. And when he went to Congress, I was like, oh yeah, that tracks. Like this, he'll do well there. But yeah, it's, and I'm sure you've heard lots of kind of weird stories like that along the way.
Well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but I know that he was king of the state house.
He was.
But and I when people tell me about, you know, what are you doing running against him and like feel sorry for him, I'm like, you don't. This guy is so powerful. What are you talking about? But I'm surprised he was in his office. That you were able to spend the day with him.
It was definitely an interesting experience. And I guess if I had it all to do over again, I'd still do it because it was just such a good, weird, out of body kind of a thing. But, and I will say that, you know, that the caucus did, you know, depose him basically of his position. We had fought,
you know, what happened?
With the leadership elections.
Why he lost his power.
I'd be curious to hear your take on it.
My take. Yeah. He had a neighborhood organization.
Oh yeah. The jazz festival and all of that.
And the nightclub.
Yeah.
That he was funneling state dollars into, investigated by the FBI, had to give the money back, and then he was no longer a chair.
Well, and he still almost was a chair, you know, because leadership elections are a big deal. And really what it boiled down to was it was a combination of factors, but it was a leadership election where it swung wildly towards Allegheny County. We put in Joe Markozik from Allegheny County as the chair, and a lot of it had to do with ending the kind of despot kind of, you know, heavy-handed approach. You know, and not only that, and I guess this was, maybe he viewed this as part of his job, but there was a disproportionate amount of dollars going to Philly for those kind of projects. And it was like, hey, right, we've got people, you know, we could politically help Democrats in a lot of areas if we could do some things, but you're putting money into these kind, you know, I would see what other colleagues from Philly were getting money for, and I'd be like, this is insane. This isn't even good politics. This is just... Someone's getting rich off of this, and it's not good. So, okay, great. We only have about 5 minutes, and I do want to get to the stripper thing, if you don't mind. And I feel even kind of skeezy talking about it because I'm a guy, but like the thing that I like about it, the way you've handled it, not that I like that you were a stripper. That's your, yeah, that's not my issue. The thing that I like about the way you handled it was you're doing this thing that, and I saw it in some other interviews, that a lot of candidates are doing now, which is you're taking what would be the thing they would attack you on, you're owning it, and you're doing it on your terms. Mm-hmm. And I think that's awesome. You know, my favorite example of that is Bethany Hallam, Allegheny County Councilwoman. You know, when she ran as a you know, recovering addict. And it was like, well, now you can't hurt me with it. You know?
Right.
But when you, how long, and if any of this is something you don't want to talk about, please, you know, I understand. But how long were you a stripper for?
Just during college. I thought about when I came to Philly for grad school, I thought about stripping again. But at that time, I was still on my track to pursue medicine, and I was worried that I would see some of the doctors or medical school administration at the club and then
awkward
have them interview me for medical school. And I just didn't think that that would end up working in my favor. So I did not. I worked in restaurants instead.
Are you in favor of legalizing sex work?
Legalizing is different than decrim.
Okay, decrim, that's where you're at?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's just because it's hard to, from a legalized definition, it's hard to put laws that would govern someone's body and not violate bodily autonomy.
Fair enough.
You're able to use it, like if you want to use your body to have sex and make money from it, then any sort of law that could restrict or regulate that is a little,
right.
It's tough.
Right. I get it. That makes total sense. Do you running for office now, do you regret that that's something that you have to address, or that's something that you could be defined by, or kind of, you know, having people that have different opinions kind of demean you based on that?
Do I regret it? No. Does it hurt? Yeah. I mean, my skin's gotten pretty thick, but it's still, there's still so much stigma. I was pushed out of a job because of it. And now I'm full-time on the campaign, and whatever happens next, I don't know if I'm going to be a viable candidate for going back into my field, which is public health. And so we'll see. I really just threw myself into this, and we'll see what happens. But I do know that this is opening a door for other candidates who might have a spicy past, mm-hmm. To be forward and upfront about it. And if anyone criticizes them, they can point at our campaign and say, were you as hard on her or, you know, whatever. And we can try to absorb all of that stigma as much as possible.
One of the lines that always stuck with me when I was fighting for environmental advocacy in a place that was clearly just not interested in it, was, you know, the first one over the fence always gets bloody. And, you know, and it sounds like you're experiencing some of that. Is it more from men, more from women? What's the kind of vibe that you get?
Definitely more from white men. I know
we suck. No, it's okay. We suck.
So when from men of color, it's just been like, oh, wow, you are being really vulnerable. And it also, it helps people to understand that I can relate to hardship and struggle, and policy that is dehumanizing. So I think that is helpful in many cases, but I think with white men, sometimes it's often hard to relate to that. And so, there's a lot of that patriarchal, just oppress, you know, something that is unfamiliar, and stomp it out.
Well, you know, I spoke with Christy Nibus, who ran up in Erie for Congress, and she told me, and she's, you know, an attractive younger woman, and she told me that, you know, when she was making fundraising calls and stuff, I mean, she was basically directly propositioned for sex, you know, as part of the fundraising process. I mean, have you run into that where there are guys that are just like, well, I could probably get her because, you know, they have this, you know, really messed up, warped image in their mind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had to listen to, you know, comments made as they like look up our website on the internet and see my picture and things like that.
And they're like, oh, you're hot, or yeah, whatever.
They, oh, you're too attractive to be in politics.
Ew, that's such a skeezy thing to say.
Yeah. So usually I just am like, you know, I think I'm going to make my next phone call just to keep your money.
What about from women? Do you get kind of like they'll look down their nose from you? Like I could see, I guess if you were running the suburbs, it would be a very different kind of a thing, but.
So the suburbs was where I got I was coaching soccer out in the suburbs. And so those mothers were the ones who pushed me out of my job. Well, they pushed the club to push me out of my job. And so, yeah, I would expect that in the suburbs, it would be much, much harder. For the people, the women who have been drawn into our campaign, it's been more shock, just, and then like, wow, you're really brave. There was one woman who was disgusted by it over the phone, but usually people I come in contact with, are usually pretty progressive. Right. The women at least. And I think more what draws in hate is my openness about having an abortion. And so the pro-lifers kind of call me a murderer and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that comes from women.
Yeah. And that, you have to just kind of wear that as a badge of honor. I mean, I always say when some of the people that are just, not good people in terms of what they, the hypocrisy of how they want to, dictate how we handle our bodies and make choices, when they're shooting at you, you kind of know you're doing something right. So at least that's more of a traditional kind of a thing where like you can have people out there that can relate to you and, you're not the first person to go down that road. Whereas with some of the other stuff, it's gotta be challenging because there's really very little that you can draw, experience from or relate to, so.
It's lonely for sure.
Yeah.
And I think running outside of the party, as an insurgent campaign, as an insurgent challenger, you got to prepare for the loneliness of it. And even getting into office, I anticipate it still being a lonely venture.
And I know we have to go in a second, but I agree with you. There were times when towards the end where I'd kind of stuck my flag in the ground and said, this is how things are going to be. And it was very lonely. It was a great word to describe it. Even among my own colleagues, among people that I had worked with and trusted and done things with for years. And then all of a sudden you see that those relationships are very superficial. They're mm-hmm. not, it's hard to find a more selfish profession than elected politics, and it is so because, I came in with this naivete. I was about the same age you are now. And I was like, we're a team. We're going to work together. We're going to get things done. And then you get there and you're like, this is just everybody doing their own thing and making deal. Like people would make deals behind closed doors. And you're like, how could you do that? You screwed the team. And then you realize there's really not. Yeah, the team is, but there's only a team when they need you to do something, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, we have to do this. And you're like, whoa, what's this we bullshit? Like, where's this coming from? So, it sounds silly to someone that's never been through it. But I mean, really, it's to do what you're doing is brave, because you've taken, especially someone like you who has elements of your past, like you said, you're not ashamed of, but there's a difference of between that and not necessarily having it put on blast all over the country, right? I always say I'm an interesting Google, right? Because some of the things have happened in my past. I mean, that's going to be you. Like when people Google you for the rest of your life, there are going to be things out there that maybe you don't want to be the things you're defined by, So, and the fact that you're choosing to put yourself out there because of the things you believe in is brave. There's really no other way to put it. So if nobody else has thanked you for running today, I'm going to thank you for running because win or lose, it's so important to bring those conversations up and to, like you said, pave the way for other candidates in the future.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I know we need to go. Any last thoughts, any way and give everybody their ways to get in touch with you.
Thank you for having me. I was excited to come on this. I love a Pennsylvania based podcast. So thank you for having this podcast. To get in touch, there's Hunt for Congress is our website, spell everything out. And our social media is Alexandra Hunt for Congress. Again, spell everything out for Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And for Twitter, it's A Hunt, 4 Congress.
Awesome. And if you haven't, for the listeners, if you didn't listen to part one where we talked about her TikTok, please follow her TikTok. It's great. It's exactly what you would. It's going to be hilarious because in 5 years, there will be candidates doing that kind of stuff all over the place. And that's just how it's going to work. So, Alexandra, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it. I would love to get you back on before the primary. I know it's going to get busier and busier, even if it's just for like a half an hour, just to get an update to see how things are going, because this is a really fascinating campaign. And, if things swing the way you're working towards, I think you're in a position to make history, and that's something to be really proud of.
Thank you.
Thank you very much again, everybody. Alexandra Hunt, look her up, check her out. It's definitely a fascinating campaign. So thank you very much for listening to the Keystone Reckoning podcast. I'm Jesse White. Have a great day.
Well, that's it then. We've saved people the trouble of voting. What's next?
Our point is that it's...
I understood the point. We're going to South Carolina to set up Illinois. When I ask what's next, it means I'm ready to move on to other things. So, what's next?
We're done.
Fantastic.